To kick off today's show, a plug for PASIC 2017 by today's guest, Percussive Arts Society Executive Director Joshua Simons.
There's no reason not to come to PASIC if you still haven't come. You can still get your tickets online, buy them online, because you can come and stand in line at PASIC. We're going to charge you more. I think the lineup is incredible this year. The big concerts. So you got Wednesday night, you got Shi Iwu, Sandbox Percussion, and then Steve Schick. On Thursday night, you got the Chad Wackerman Trio. On Friday night, you got So Percussion. And on Saturday night, you got Steve Smith with the Airmen of Note. And those are just the evening concerts. Other things you don't want to miss. You don't want to miss anything. If you're into marching, we got the Blue Devils. If you like Broadway musicals, we got Andres Ferraro. Andres is the drummer for Hamilton on Broadway. He's been with Lin-Manuel for many years with In the Heights, and he's going to do a special thing there. We got Blue Man Group coming to do a special clinic, and they will not be in their blue. And we put this special together because when they are in their costume, they can't talk. That's just part of their thing, no matter where they're at. So they won't be in costume, so they can actually do a clinic performance and talk to the audience about how they work with the musicians on stage, their music director who plays drum set, and that will be a really great experience. We have the Focus Day with so many incredible concerts. Marimelin, Nancy's on the cover of our PASIC preview. Our Hall of Famers, we're gonna induct four Hall of Famers into the Hall of Fame. Andy Norell, percussion group Cincinnati, Zeffirino Nandayapa, and Bobby Hutchinson. So, I mean, just incredible musicians. The most important thing I think to come to PASIC, and my friend Mike Balter shared this with me when I first got the job, was it's a family reunion. It's a place for us to hang as drummers and percussionists, to get together once a year with our own people, and it really is. It really is a special place. So if you've never been, you should check it out. If you've been for many years, you know how special they are and how different each one is. And I can only hope that you will enjoy this one as much as you enjoyed other ones that you've been to in the past.
Thank you, Joshua. Now on with the show. Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito. Thank you for being here for episode 62 and my conversation with the gentleman you've already heard from, PAS Executive Director Joshua Simons. This interview was suggested by a previous podcast guest and PAS President Brian Zader, and I was glad he suggested it and Joshua was up for it. As this episode is coming out 1 week before the Percussive Arts Society's annual convention, I will, like last year, be previewing PASIC 2017 with interviews with some of the folks doing clinics and concerts. But let's get started with Joshua Simons, who oversees PASIC and the Rhythm Discovery Center in Indianapolis. We recorded this interview over Skype on October 23rd, 2017, and it begins right now. Joshua, tell me about getting the job as executive director and where you were before and the process hereunto.
Yeah. So let's see. I've now been at PAS since I started in end of July of 2016. Mm-hmm. And for a job interview process, it actually went pretty quickly with something that I wasn't used to. Prior to coming to PAS, I was at the Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestras for many years in different capacities, but being executive director there for the last 3 years. Okay. And really wasn't looking for another job at all. I had a great job, great organization. I love that organization. And essentially had been with that organization for about 14 years. And a friend of mine said, hey, PAS is looking for a new executive director. I was like, oh, that's cool. You should think about it. I'm like, no, that's not like PAS. Like, they don't want they don't want me, you know, like I haven't drummed in years and whatever, you know, just thinking, just, you know, percussive art society, when I was younger, that was obviously, you know, PASIC and PAS and Days of Percussion were just amazing. And my friend said, well, you know, you should really think about it. And I said, well, I'll look a little more into it. I said, but I'm really not looking to leave Chicago and that whole family thing. So, you know, I thought about it, talked to my wife. I said, all right, I'll send in a letter expressing interest. And I thought, you know, it's good. I hadn't taken an interview in a while. So like any professional, it's good to keep our chops up, you know, whether it's with drumming or taking interviews, you know, or taking an audition. Sometimes it's good just to take an audition, right? Just to see how you compare to other people.
Yeah.
So I took an interview and where I sent my stuff in, they called and they said, hey, we'd like to set up a Skype interview. I said, great. So I did that interview in April. And then a few hours later, they called me and said, we'd like to bring you to Indianapolis. And I was like, whoa, this is moving pretty fast.
Yeah.
So and I did that interview from California. I was actually on vacation. And then so I went back home, set up, you know, the interview in Indianapolis, went out to Indianapolis, and just felt like everything really clicked really well. You know, I came, they gave me a tour of Rhythm Discovery Center. We spoke at length about some of the issues that they have wanted to make PAS better, what I could bring to that. And I think a lot of it had to do with my background in nonprofit arts management. You know, I think the thing about PAS is there's so many things that we're doing well. But from a standpoint of governance, from fundraising, maybe marketing, all those, you know, non-PASIC performance things or day percussion things, you know, I'm not looking to come in here and say, hey, let's do all this artistic, you know, the artistic product differently. It was about how can we make all these other parts of PAS that maybe the member doesn't see as good as, you know, the PASICs, the days of percussion, the things that we do better than anyone else already. And if we could bring every part of PAS up to that level, we would be a organization that was, you know, at the level of any other amazing organization in this country. And I think that was the point. So I was able to come in here and really take a look at it from a sense of, you know, structure, budget, all that non-sexy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the interview was more of a conversation, which is the way I like to do it. And it was, I was very upfront. I said, you know, I don't think you're doing this well. I don't think you're doing this well. I think we could do this a lot better. And we just had a really good meeting. And I was fortunate where they offered me the job. And I went back, spoke to my wife about it. And we thought this was the right time in our life to, my daughter was about to start kindergarten. Mm-hmm. So it was the right time to actually have a new chapter in our life. And so I took the job. And got right to work. I was even doing some work in between the time. So we actually moved here in July, and I remember there was a few. What's the best way of putting it? There were a few issues that came up last year. I don't need to rehash, but right before PASIC, and jumped right on in to help them, you know, solve some of these problems. So I was actually working kind of two jobs at once, but it was no problem. That's just the way I am, and wanted to. Make, you know, I said, I've been trying to have this job, so we might as well start to make it as successful as I can right from, you know, the moment I accepted the job. So probably that was in late April, early May of 2016, and here I am now.
Great.
That's the short of it.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's a great answer. When you're preparing for the interview for PAS, what types of things are you preparing? Because I mean, I'm thinking about it from, you know, if you're preparing for a college job, you're going to have to play a concert, you're going to have to like talk about studio, like all those things. So what types of things in that vein were you having to get ready to take this interview?
Yeah, I had to do a lot with, so I think it's, there are two interviews to prepare for.
Mm-hmm.
Same way that with Well, really three, in the same way that an audition or a college job could be, right?
Yeah.
You have to get your paperwork such that, you know, to me, the resume and the cover letter, that person sounds interesting, let's talk to them.
Yeah.
Right? And then once you get past that, then it's about the in-person, or in this case, the Skype, to sell yourself.
Sure.
Then it's that, okay, this person still is intriguing us, now we want to see them in person. That's where it's up to you to close the door, right? That's the finals.
Sure.
Type of thing. So the first round, sending the paperwork, is strictly, you know, write a good letter, show them that you're competent, and show them that you have the qualifications to do the and what the job said. You know, do you understand all these things? Yes. Mm-hmm. Great. Now it's a Skype interview, and now this is where they're going to ask you a lot of the questions about, you know, you want to really understand the finances of the organization. You want to understand the structure of the organization. You want to understand programs. You want to understand why they've done things a certain way and what they're looking to change in the future. So it's also a listening tour. In that first one, you're really trying to pick up on what the board is saying,
right?
And then start to shape things. So when they say a lot while they're talking about what they're looking for, and then you take that and start to kind of adapt it. But so I'm just trying to prepping for that. It's just trying to learn as much history and as much of its history, and then the current processes of the organization, and trying to really understand why they're doing it, and then in the back of your head have a playbook of saying, okay, well, if I were in that job, this is how I might handle that situation. This is how I might, you know, prepare for that program, whatever it may be, and then talk about execution without giving too much away, because you don't want to give too much away. Essentially, if you want my playbook, you have to hire me.
Right. So before you go on, what when you did the Skype interview, how many people were on the other end?
Oh. Five or six.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm going to assume you weren't wearing like a Michael Jordan rookie season jersey on at that point.
Was not, especially as a Laker fan.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. Excuse me. A James Worthy jersey.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. And we can totally talk sports.
Oh, yeah. Now that I know that, we can – we'll factor that in later.
Because actually we are – tomorrow starts the World Series, and I am a huge Dodger fan.
Oh, so there you go.
I'm sorry to all my friends down in Houston. Mm-hmm. Who hopefully will listen to this, but
it's our time. It ain't happening. That's what you're saying.
It's our time.
And I know Houston, you guys haven't ever won a World Series, but seriously, it's our time.
That doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. They've had something. I don't know.
Right.
You have to throw that in there. Now, awesome. Great. Now I'm gonna feel guilty, right? Because they have never won. And it's been 29 years for me. No, when I do any type of audition and any type of, it's weird for me personally. What even if I'm on a phone call, mm-hmm. I still want to be in a suit or feel, right. I want to feel the part.
Yeah.
So I can't actually, in good conscience, like take a job interview like wearing like shorts and
sure.
You know, flops. I'm not the guy who wears the tie and then wears shorts.
On yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I,
yeah.
I actually am wearing, you know, I actually am wearing, but that's also how I dress every day to sure. work. So, no, but it's no different than taking a job interview or, audition or whatever, you know, dress the part.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you know, you want to look, now for that Skype interview, I was actually on vacation.
Right.
So,
did you have a suit with you?
Well, I didn't know I was going to do the Skype interview until I was already on vacation.
That's what I've, yeah.
Yeah, they actually said, could you actually do this? And I was like, well, I'm in California right now. And I was actually did it from my parents, like their office. So it was a weird setup anyway. It was a little, you know, flying out the next day type of thing. So, yeah, I pulled something together. I'm not exactly sure how I did it. But, you know, you do what you have to do.
There wasn't a picture of you in ninth grade marching band or something like that in the background?
No, there wasn't. Thank goodness. I made sure. That's also a very good point. No, always make – even if there was, I would have taken it down. Make sure there's nothing too distracting.
Yeah.
You know, make sure make sure when you're on a Skype interview that there's one focal point, and that's you.
Yeah.
Don't let them be like, what? What's behind – what is that? You know? What's that weird stuff? You know, don't give them any reason not to like you,
right,
except for your answers.
Yes. That's the largest pair of glasses I've ever seen.
What is that? Like, what kind of furniture does that guy have? Or, you know, that is old carpet.
Yeah.
No, like, I tell people, it's like, no distractions. Like, it's about you. And if they don't like you because your answer is, that's fine. But don't let them have another reason not to. So, yeah, do everything that you would. A Skype interview is no different than a in-person interview. It really is an in-person interview. So, but yes, that's how I prep for it. And I also, you know, sometimes I tape things up against the wall.
Oh, okay.
Where they can't see big, like if I got to remember something, it could be, just a big word.
Yeah.
You know, to remind me, okay, make sure I get that in there because that's an important thing. Mm-hmm. To me, the hardest, the one thing I always prep for, and this would be my advice to any young person listening to this, is the hardest question to answer is the, tell me about yourself. I guarantee you, if you haven't prepped for tell me about yourself, it's going to sound something like this. Yeah, okay, so I, you know, right now I'm in college and then, you know, I used to, I went to high school somewhere, but then I got this, and it's all over the place. And it's like, you have to actually outline tell me about yourself.
Yeah.
And I'd be happy to. You know, currently I'm the executive director of Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestra. I've been there for 14 years, and during that time, and then prior to that, I was at American University. You know, and you have to, you know, almost memorize it.
Yeah.
You have to really understand, tell me about yourself. If you don't, if you can't even tell them about you, how are you going to expect them to understand anything else? So
sure.
You think it's the easiest thing because you know yourself better than anyone else.
Right.
But to actually articulate that is a very tricky thing. So make sure you can actually tell people about yourself.
Yeah. And as you're explaining, not a bad idea to record that and listen to yourself and go, oh my God.
the amount of ums and ands will kill you the same way that if you don't record yourself playing and you're like, wow, I hit, you know, I hit the rim of that of the snare so many times, or I'm hitting the bad part of the you know. Listen, I have my undergrad in percussion, and we talk about transferable skills, you know, a lot in life, you know, and as a musician, those are things, you know, we want our voice, whether the voice is talking or your voice is playing, mm-hmm. to come across as best as possible. So whether in an audition, whether in an interview, that is critical. So, and to really, you know, make sure you know, you would never go into an audition not being prepared. And some these questions that they ask you are very much like sight reading. Yeah. You don't know what they're going to say, but hopefully you have the structure on how to answer no matter what they put in front of you. Mm-hmm. And that is a very important thing. So thinking about so many, I have pages full of questions that I've been asked over the years, mm-hmm. in notes. Every interview I take, I try to remember a few of the notes and I put that into a document, and then I go back and I answer that question. Yeah. And so prior to an interview, I read through pages and pages of interview notes. There's also the questions that people will ask you, and if they ask me those questions, I kind of then say, ah, that's the type of board we're dealing with, or that's the type of people we're dealing with. Mm. I'm not ever a fan of the, you know, what's your biggest strength? What's your biggest weakness?
Right.
It's like, that's, I mean, come on.
What is that? So, because you brought that up, what do you think, if you hear a question like that, what are you thinking? Like, they're not prepared. They don't know what they want. Is that where this is at?
That if at my level,
mm-hmm.
as executive director,
yeah,
there are other questions we should be concerned about.
Right.
You know, what's your biggest weakness? Like, really? What's my biggest weakness? Like, we all know what's going to happen. I'm going to spin it to be the positive weakness,
right.
You know? you know, oh, I'm too hard of a worker. Like, what's my biggest weakness? I like candy. My teeth are going to go bad. You're going to have to get dental insurance for me. I don't know.
I don't like doing push-ups. I mean, I know I should.
Exactly. I don't like to exercise. Like, what are you talking about? What's my biggest weakness? You know? So things like that. So when that tells me is that, yeah, maybe, but you can spin that as a positive. Okay, this is a board. This is a group of people who might need my help. Hey, next time, instead of asking that, ask me what my philosophy on fundraising is. Mm-hmm. That probably would have been a better question for this role than what are three words that describe you, you know? Yeah. Joshua Aaron Simons. Those are the three words that describe who I am. You know, however, knows my middle name.
I am amazing. Yes.
Yeah. Right, exactly. You know. But it's also a learning thing, right? Mm-hmm. The people, you have to all remember the people also giving the interview. They're not perfect people, and they're not, you know. And also on boards, they don't do this for a living. So it is a constant, you know, work thing, but it does give you a good sense of, you know, maybe how the rest of the interview is going to go.
Sure.
Okay. All those other questions, maybe, okay, I'm going to actually, okay, the things on the wall over there, you know, because I still have those up, you know, what are three words? Always have you still got to have the three words that describe yourself. And you have plenty of time to make sure that you don't say, you know, smart, creative, you know, and loyal. You know, sure, it could be, but you can also say a lot of other really interesting words like agile. Right. That's my favorite one. So if anyone now steals that one, you know, agile, ooh, tell me about that. Well, you know, it's about making calls, being on the move. At any moment, you get to switch to do whatever use a word you want to, and then go to the thesaurus and find a better version of that word and set yourself apart. Yeah. So it's the little things.
Yeah.
My wife is a nonprofit professional as well. So we do a lot of talking about these things anyway, you know. And she's very good about that, but no, we don't do that. We don't like to make fun of each other's cooking.
Oh no, I would not.
No, but we do. No, but but having a wife that and friends in the industry, we do share a lot about, you know, arts administrators also talk to each other the same way musicians talk to each other. Yeah. Oh my God, that, you know, the audition or that person, whatever, we're the same way. It's like, oh, like, what's the worst question you've ever been asked on a, you know, or what's a weird request, you know, a board member or a member has ever, you know, asked, and you do it with a smile. Yeah. And then you have people you can talk to about that same way musicians do, you know, mm-hmm. we're no different.
Great. When you do the on-site part of the interview, do you have to do any, is there a presentation recommended of you, or are you just having conversations?
Conversations.
Okay.
Yeah. I have been asked to do that once. Someone, that was a really weird interview. I didn't take the job, nor I don't think I was even offered it. Uh-huh. But on site, they asked me to do a writing. They wanted me to see what my writing was like. And instead of asking me to bring something, they wanted me to write something there. They said, we're going to 30 minutes. We're going to leave you here. And could you write us like a press release or like a something about a grant? I was just like, okay. Yeah, I was like, I am not working with you people.
Right. Yeah.
That was a strange one. That was really strange. Like, I did not see that one coming. Sometimes people will say, you know, can we see your writing? Yeah, of course you can see my writing. But to do it on, like, they were giving me a test. I was like, no, we're not going to do that. No, it really is about when you get into much more in-depth conversation.
Sure.
That's where what you say in that room, no one can take offense to it, mm-hmm. right? Because at that moment, at this level of conversation, you are going to start. I think I would hope that they want me to really at that point say, okay, I'm not sure why you do this. Because all the other nonprofit organizations I've worked with do this, this, and this. So give me a reason other than it's the way that we've always done it.
Right.
You know, why? What's the why?
Yeah.
Because a board should always know the why.
Yeah.
And if you can't, then it's something. So we really get in-depth conversation. That's where you have to be prepared to kind of sweat a little bit. Because you're going to say things that are going to offend people who have been doing, like, you know, it may have been their project or their pet thing. And then I come in and say, I actually wouldn't have ever done that.
Right.
And then you have to say the why. Because X, Y, and Z, you know, whatever it may be. So, but that was a good, and that's a day and a half. You come in, you generally, the way it works is you come in, you meet with lots of people. You also meet with community people, right? In Indianapolis, you meet with people from Visit the City. You meet with other. So when I was here, I met with people from Visit Indy who were real instrumental in bringing PAS to Indianapolis, you know, many years ago, and our great partner. I met with Eric Martin, who's the CEO of Music for All. I met with many board members, the staff. I had a meeting with the staff, and my request for that was I didn't want any board members in that meeting. That's something that I do. I want to have an open conversation with the staff without board there.
Yeah.
Let's talk. Everything stays in the room during that conversation. There's no, you know, I'm not going to tell the board what the staff says. I'm not going to tell the staff what the board says. But it's good not to have either there, so they can really feel that they can talk to you about it. And you learn a lot during that time.
Did you meet with any BOA people?
Yeah, Eric Martin.
Oh, okay.
Eric Martin, MF, Music for All. Yeah, so Eric is the CEO, and I did meet with him. And he was a very large reason why, you know, we spoke then, and then we spoke after. I went back to Chicago and I called him again, and he was actually very much like, you know, we need you here in Indianapolis. Like, you know, and I can work really well with him. So, so that was a good, I'm glad that, you know, they introduced me to him. So the first night we had dinner, and they treat you right. They put you up a nice hotel. We went to St. Elmo's for dinner. You know, they really try to sell you on the city.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then full day of meetings, you know, prior, and then the next day, and with many different constituents.
Yeah.
Then obviously a lot of board.
Yeah. When it was done, where were you at mentally at that point? Aside from tired, because you talked to.
Yeah.
For an hour.
I was feeling very excited. You know. At CYSO, like I said earlier, I wasn't looking for another job because I had a great job.
Yeah.
And when I've taken a lot of these interviews, at the end of the interviews, a lot of the time I always said to myself, you know, the better job is the current job I have. I've always had this idea of, you know, when people say, you know, where do you want to be in 5 years? You know, my answer is generally, hopefully here, because I hope I continue to make this job better than any other job that I could get anywhere else, right? I want to continue to grow. I want to continue to do innovative projects and programs. And I was able to do that at CYSO. And no matter what, I always came back down to, the better job is the one that I keep creating for myself in that space. The same way that a university professor might feel that way. You know, how could you be somewhere for 30 years? Well, they kept growing their program and new things and having great students, you know, and as opposed to starting over somewhere. And I'm not someone who likes to just to kind of slip into, you know, something that's already, I like to build, you know, have opportunity to build my own stuff. You know, PAS and PASIC and everything else, we do Rhythm, are all really good. And I think there's opportunity, and the people who have come before me, you know, Michael Kenyon and Jeff Hartso, have done amazing, amazing work. And because of the ground that they laid has given me opportunity to kind of move, you know, continue to grow, you know, the organization. Same thing with, you know, the board, and starting with all the past presidents and then the board. But PAS is still at a place where we can continue to expand and really refine some of the things we're doing, and look at best practices, you know, what other associations are doing, even beyond the music association. So that to me was also the exciting part, that it was a real stable organization, but still there was opportunity to continue to have new ideas and grow and want to kind of grow the organization in many different ways. And so in the end, it was – I felt very excited about that. That and they let me sit behind Neil Peart's drum kit.
I mean, you know, if you need a way to just cap the job off for you, to, you know, did you play any Limelight or something like that?
I did not touch it.
Okay.
I just sat on the. I asked for a picture.
Uh-huh.
And, I was like, can I sit behind it? They're like, yeah, sure. And then I went home. I was like, oh my God, Neil Peart's drum kit is in the museum. and if I get the job, I'll run the museum.
Yes.
That is the most amazing thing ever. it was nice. It was nice scene. But it was, I was fortunate to receive an offer very soon after that interview.
Mm-hmm.
And took a little time to talk it over with my family.
Yep.
And we decided it was the best thing for both me professionally, us as a family, my daughter, and all those things come into play when you have a family. So,
yeah.
But in the end, it each part of it, personal and professional, we felt it was the right time, the right thing to do.
Yeah. In a nonprofit position, was there anything that to negotiate contract wise?
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I think people – so my soapbox about nonprofit – so I've always – my whole life I have been in the nonprofit world.
Mm-hmm.
So nonprofit doesn't mean no profit.
Yeah.
It's nonprofit, right? You can make money in nonprofit. The money just goes back into the organization. We don't put it back into its shareholders.
Right.
Right? The shareholders are its members. So if you end up with a surplus, what can we do with that money to further better the organization? It's okay to have a surplus. Now, yeah. We're a nonprofit. We're not ending up with millions and millions of dollars in, you know, we're only a $1.5 million organization anyway.
Yeah.
And all this stuff is open. You know, you can check out any nonprofit's, you know, finances. And it's, I think the responsibility of members to actually do that, you know, mm-hmm. understand what it is. But PAS is a stable organization. So yeah, of course there is, there's always room for, you know, negotiation. It's my job, right? It's also, I also have to take care of my family.
Right.
You know, and I came from a job. So sure, you know, but I will say that the PAS board was very generous in, their initial offer. I didn't have to actually really go back more at all. And coming from Chicago to Indianapolis for the cost of living was quite much less. It was you know, a good thing all around. But that's definitely something you have to think about. You know, it's as much as you love an organization or a job, make sure that you and your family are taken care of. That right. That's obviously an important thing. So and my family comes first. PAS second, but my family first.
And in that sense, did you know when you got the offer, did you even go back to CYSO, or were you like, no, I've already this is already good enough?
Yeah. It was time for me to leave CYSO.
Okay.
Like I said, I always loved that organization, and I feel like I did a lot of good there. Mm-hmm. But it was time for some new energy, and I think hopefully a lot, and I feel that hopefully that will go down as a people will respect that in the end.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't want to become the person at an organization who it becomes all about them. And part of me felt like it was became the Joshua Show.
Mm.
And I didn't want that, you know. New ideas, new people. I got it to a level, and now I wanted hopefully some new vision, new ideas, new energy. But we had taken it. I mean, in the course of my time being there, you know, we grew. When I got there, we served about 225 people. By the time we left, it was more than 700. We had two orchestras, and we had seven orchestras in the children program when I left. And that was because of a great staff, great board, people willing to go with it. And it was tiring also.
Yeah.
You know? To constantly, you know, and dealing with, as everyone knows, dealing with youth and parents and family, that is a tiring, tiring job.
Yeah.
And so I think also just a change professionally, was, I think deep down I was looking for. So I kind of, you know, it was very easy when they came to with the first offer, which was, I didn't actually go back and ask for anything else. I think a few extra vacation days. I had reached a level at CYSO, a few extra vacation days. Not like as a nonprofit manager, you use your vacation days anyway,
right?
But just to have them. There's never a vacation that I go that I ever shut off. I mean, you are on 7 days a week, 300, and it's literally 365 days a year. I don't ever not check my email. I think I mentioned it once in a Rhythm Scene. I did a profile in our Rhythm Scene magazine, which is a great magazine. And if you don't check it out, you should. It's free. But there was a profile, and it's the first thing I do when I wake up. It's the last thing I do before I go to bed. It's checking an email.
Yeah.
But that's just, I mean, kind of the life we live right now.
One thing I definitely do want to ask you about, I'm going to get to some more specific PAS stuff, but I do want you to talk a little bit about nonprofits and burnout, because it is a really tough job. And like you said, your wife does the same type of work. So yeah. What have you seen over the years that you've been working in a nonprofit organization situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is a lot of burnout in nonprofit work. Oh, wow. That is a tough question. I'm not going to lie. It's not for everybody.
Yeah.
It's definitely not for everybody. And I am lucky to be in a position where, to be the executive director, obviously I'm compensated more fairly than others. But I was in a time in my life where, you know, there was a time in my life where I think my first job, I made $30,000 a year, and I worked, you know, 60 hours a week, and was nonstop going, but you were just lucky to have it.
Yeah.
And that's even now nice now. I mean, I do all I can to make sure that my staff is definitely fairly compensated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good thing, because you want people to be invested in the organization.
Yeah.
I think what causes burnout is when people are expected to work a ton, aren't paid fairly, and their voice isn't heard.
Yeah.
I think people who work in nonprofits are willing to sacrifice a little bit, and that's generally pay.
Right.
Compared to our friends in the corporate world.
Yeah.
But the difference is your voice matters. Mm-hmm. And I have always been someone, and will continue to be someone, that I don't care whether you're the president of the board or our intern. If you have an idea, if you are passionate about something, I will listen. But in the end, it does come down to then me kind of sorting through things. But it doesn't take any bit to listen to somebody. Mm-hmm. I have people call me from in a given week, I can talk to Steve Smith, and I can talk to a high school student. Mm-hmm. That's the range of people who will call on the phone.
Uh-huh.
And every one of them is as important as the other. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to also listen to everybody, we have to listen to ourselves. I think where burnout happens more is when you get put into an organization that they just need a lot of worker bees. And then you're putting so much time and effort in for someone else's vision, for someone else's, you know, ideas. One of my roles here is to build consensus, mm-hmm, and share with the staff why we're doing things, what the vision, what their role in that is, so that they have buy-in. If you don't have buy-in, how can you expect someone to put in the extra hours, the extra time? You know, we don't get bonuses in nonprofit. We don't get, you know, at the end of the year, we don't get anything like that. You make a salary, and that's what you're going to get. And you're probably not going to get a raise year to year. Every few years, we try to, you know, do an increase in living. I mean, it's just a different world than the corporate world. But it's that passion for the thing you're doing, and that real connection, and that, you know, something that I said or did is now part of something larger. And it's not just, we're not a top-down organization. You know, I try to sit in circles more than, you know, or around or a rectangular table where you don't know where it starts or ends. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's important. It's, you know, there is never, I generally don't have meetings where I'm locking out other staff members. You know, it's either I'm on the phone with someone or everything is open. Transparency. And that's where, you know, so that I think helps the burnout, because then people are still excited about coming into work. Yeah. Because, and everyone here is really excited about coming in into work. And that's, I think, a real job of the executive director or leader to make sure that people are excited, that they want to be there, that there's constantly new projects that they can feel part of. And it's not just do this. Right. When you get to a point where it's do this, then they're going to, people are going to leave, and then you're at bad morale, a bad corporate culture. And that helps with burnout. So I have been lucky to not see burnout in the organizations that I have run. I feel like I finally come up with a good formula of my role versus staff role and how much there is together. But there are a lot of other organizations out there that, and generally they're the larger ones. And they're the larger ones that require a lot more staff, which means a lot more money. And that means they're going to pay a lot of people a little bit. And those people are going to have constant turnover, which is going to hurt, obviously, the work in the end, because you're constantly having to then retrain people. If you just pay people fairly, make sure they have their time, they're going to be better staff. Your organization is going to be better run because there's going to be more consistency over the years. In the end, that's going to help all of our members, because we're going to have better programs.
Yeah.
And we don't have to keep focusing on retraining staff. We can actually focus on the program that person has run for 3 or 4 years and making that program better. So that helps with burnout. Hopefully more people will learn that.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, what kind of stuff was your or is your wife working with, if it's the martial arts organizations?
She does. So she's worked for a lot of different organizations over her time. We met in grad school at American University doing our master's in nonprofit arts management.
Okay.
And she does a lot with fundraising, board, strategic planning. And she's currently doing some consulting work from Indianapolis. She was an executive director in Chicago. So we were both executive directors of nonprofits in Chicago. She ran an organization called Chicago Collections, which was an organization that brought together a lot of the major universities and arts organizations who had special collections on Chicago history to help bring those things under kind of one roof. And now she was a staff member of one, an executive director of one, which is a whole nother, you know, if you're that's a whole nother nonprofit where you have operations of one or two.
Yeah,
that's brutal. So God bless her. I don't know how she did that. You talk about burnout when you have to do, as she would say, you know, as a staff of one, you do copying to vision. Right. You have to do everything.
So
that's I think a lot of the burnout. If you can have a good staff where you can divvy up and really make sure that tasks are being done, but there's also vision and forward thinking, that makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about PAS. Now, when you arrive and you said you started in July of 2016, but you were still doing like a little bit of work before. Is that how you stated it?
Yes. So I was hired, and then I said, well, I need a few, you know, I can't leave right away. So I think I was hired in May and I left in July. So I gave CYSO, I think I gave them 10 or 12 weeks notice, something like that. But some issues were coming up that would affect things that would happen once I would be there. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want necessarily people making a decision that then I was going to have to deal with when I got there. I said, well, just pull me in now and I will make time to make sure that, you know, I want to be part of any decision, because if decision was going to take place, if it was going to matter in August and September, October, November, when I was already there, then I want to help make sure that we have the right decision made. And so I was on a lot of calls, a lot of emails. I was essentially kind of doing, like I said, 1.5 jobs. It wasn't full-time stuff I was doing, but I was doing a lot of PAS stuff.
Am I allowed to ask what something one of those things was when you that you were doing in that transition?
Sure. Sure.
What was one of those things, Joshua?
There was an issue with the IPET competition in 2016. This isn't a secret.
What is it, IPEC?
IPEC is the International Percussion Ensemble Competition.
Ah, got it. Okay.
And without rehashing past, there were some mistakes made on many parts. There were some mistakes made on directors who put their entries in. There were some mistakes made on the PAS staff side. Mm-hmm. And that was going to then – a lot of people had hurt feelings and the way things were handled. And I said, no, here – and I worked with everyone to essentially say, listen, we take blame. There should be blame here. And we will learn from this. And we came up with a good happy medium. I think a lot of people liked what we came up with. And essentially what happened was we ended up having an extra group perform at PASIC in the high school and the college to make sure, you know, in the end, we wanted to make sure that we weren't hurting students. Right. And I went back. That's the most important thing. Let's do what we can. Let's not worry about who messed up or this or that or this director or this. Right. What can we do to make sure we give as many students the opportunity to play? Because that's the most important thing. And I said, let's always come back to the students. And also, it's OK if a staff messes up. That's OK. You know, admit it. Move on. Say, hey, we're going to learn from this.
Yeah.
I think too many people, there's a lot of ego sometimes. There's a lot of people they don't want to. I'm okay with people messing up. Mm-hmm. I'm okay. I think it's a learning opportunity. Everyone messes up in there, right? No one gets upset about messing up. I think people get upset about not recovering, right? I think we talk about that. Obviously, I remember being in marching band when I was in a snare line, right? Instructor didn't get upset if we messed up. They got upset if we didn't recover, right? Recover as quickly as you can. Move on, mm-hmm. right? Or if you're going to mess up, right, don't let, oh my God, I messed up. And now everyone knows I messed up, right? It's, you know, you messed up, you move on. And I think when you're talking about a staff, it's okay. You know, no one is perfect. No one is perfect. But we came to a good conclusion as a staff and a board. We put out a great statement. Like I said, everything here is open and we've moved past this. I mean, it hasn't been a problem. IPEC this year was, you know, amazing, and the competition is going to be great, and we fixed everything and how people recording and uploading. It was unfortunate, but I think the most important thing that came out of it was, you know, everyone took ownership. Mm-hmm. We moved on. We made better choices for 2017, and it has been absolutely spotless. Nothing wrong at all. Everything as fair as you can have it, and that's, you know, that's the new standard moving forward.
Yeah.
You know? So it's fine, you know, but I knew that something so large that, you know, it affected a small amount of people actually, but it started to kind of blow up on social media, which sure. things can happen,
yeah,
you know, and you never want that. You want to minimize that. So I said, well, pull me into that, you know, because it also gave me a perspective from being outside. Like I looked at this, I said, well, it seems like that group of people messed up, but it also seems like we messed up.
Yeah.
And say it. Right. Hey, we're sorry. We shouldn't have done this. We're now sitting, whatever. Also, you shouldn't have done this. And then move forward. Right. You know, let's be mature and adults about this.
Yeah. I had once you stated, I was like, oh yeah, yeah. I do recall all of that happening.
But listen, that's generally what happens, right? Yeah. It's a big issue for a short amount of time, and then people forget about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. I kind of live by the 10-10-10 rule in life, and that is the when you make a decision that you think is really big, how will it affect you in 10 days? How will it affect you in 10 months? And how will it affect you in 10 years? And if the decision in after 10 days, to me, that was a 10-day thing. Mm-hmm. That was the decision we made was going to be crappy for 10 days.
Yeah.
But in 10 months, no one will have remembered it.
Right.
A very small amount of people remembered it. And in 10 years, it's a blip on the – what?
Yeah.
Oh, remember way back in 2016? No, I don't. So you have to think about how big of an issue is the thing you are talking about, and where does it fall on that line, and how much time and stress should you put into something that really, in the end, might just in 10 months or 10 days be done.
Right.
So there's a lot happening that you have to really manage how much, like I said, time and stress you're worrying about something. That one was big enough to actually pull people in, and but I think we handled it right, and that's why now people are very happy with how things are going now, and we don't have to worry about it. If we would have handled it incorrectly, I think we probably still would have been dealing with things. But like anything else in the world, take ownership, whether you know when you mess up, and learn from it.
Yeah. When you come in, you're obviously, you know, less than 4 to 5 months from, or even less than when PASIC is about to start, or your first PASIC that you're executive director, even though you weren't doing that the whole year.
Yes.
So what's been the difference? And obviously we're a couple weeks out from PASIC going
to 2017. Is it only a couple weeks?
I don't know. Is it on your calendar outlook? Like, did you put that date in there?
Did you have to remind me that we are 16 days away?
Oh wow! See, I wasn't even going to give you days, but in any case,
and I am still taking the time to do this amazing podcast. Things are so good here that I can afford the time to we are so under control. No, really, there's always things going to be right to the last second with PASIC, but we are very in control and on top of things. I think it's going to be a great show, but I'm sure we'll get to that.
Yeah. What I want to ask is what was it like to come in halfway or, you know, months before, and now what's it been like to be here for the whole cycle?
Yeah. So first of all, last year wouldn't have happened had Jeff Hartso not worked with us right through PASIC.
Okay.
And Jeff was amazing. Which kind of, because there was already so many projects he had started, and it was like, can you help? So there were certain things that I took over, and there are certain things that he kind of finished off.
Okay.
For him, it was like all the big evening concerts. You know, he had already had some of those contacts and was negotiating all that, and so he continued the kind of evening concert thing, more the actual production and artistic side of things, and I kind of then started to really just start to put my stamp on and work with more of the exhibitors and start to build those relationships from day one. So I let the team who had already been doing it, hey, finish off the production standpoint. And I started to really get into the PAS standpoint, the future things. Built, like I said, lots of meetings with exhibitors, corporate people, committee members, chapter, I met hundreds of people and had hundreds of conversations at PASIC last year. Yeah. And I think that's what it was. It was about really introducing myself, talking. If someone would stop me in the hallway, you know, I literally may have seen two or three clinics in concert last year.
I was good. Yeah, that was, I was thinking about where would you be the whole time? I would assume you would be you'd be holed up, like dealing with everything. Yeah.
I was, and it was actually looking at now, I have adjusted things for this year to make sure that doesn't happen again. The amount of meetings I went to, the amount of extra conversations, I've tried to structure, and that's been helping during the year, structure the calendar, structure my time so that I can have meetings, I can still have impromptu meetings, I can set things up earlier, I can go see concerts and clinics. So I want to see firsthand these amazing, you know, artists that we have coming in. And if I can see with my own eyes, then I can actually say, hey, next year we need to think about this or this or this, you know, the production value, and start to really get in that.
Yeah.
So how we're setting up the calendar, why things might look a little bit different, or switching of rooms, or big pet peeve of mine, and I probably said once already, is, you know, well, that's the way we've always done it.
Right.
Anyone in the staff knows if they're about to say that they should rethink how they say that. Like, if it comes out of their, I'm like, think again what you're going to say. Rephrase it. But this year I am, and there's also a little more ownership, obviously, this year, right?
Yeah.
A lot of it has been done, and I've talked to so many of these artists and these exhibitors, whatever it may be. So I want to make sure that we are walking around doing that. And that's also with the board. We structured our board meetings. Obviously, we only get together once every few months in person,
right?
Three times a year, essentially, one of them at PASIC. And so the board wants that in-person time. But it's also important to make sure that we as a board, executive director board, are walking around seeing people, seeing the concert, walking around thanking people for being there, you know, getting out. If you're just behind a door in the Westin or in the convention center somewhere, that's not any good. So I want us to get out, really talk and see things and be with people, and hopefully you will see more of that this year.
Yeah.
But it was definitely different. But I'm also someone who, I came in, I was going to, I remember I came into the office. It was my first day on the job was technically the July board summit where people came to town. So all the board was in town, and it was like, you know, it was a big happy best. Oh, congratulations, you're here. Oh, it's good to work. You know, we did a lot of good work. And then the following Monday, I started in the office without the board, and Monday, Tuesday. And I remember I kept saying to myself, go slow. You know, there's no reason to scare the staff. And I think by Wednesday I walked in and the office is so quiet and everyone is just so siloed.
Yeah.
And doing their own thing. And I finally opened my door and I was like, I can't take this anymore. Like, where's the conversation? Where's the collaboration? And I made people like talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And I said, I promised myself I wasn't going to do this. I was going to like give it time, but it was like the third day. I was like, nope, never mind. And that's just who I am though. Things are changing right now.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to have meetings. We're going to talk to each other. We're going to talk. What are you doing? How can we work together? How can we make things better?
Yeah.
You know, why are you doing that by yourself? Don't you need this person's help? So I trying to do that. And now a year after that, the culture in the office is so different.
Mm.
We are constantly talking, we're meeting, we're sharing ideas, people are helping each other. That's just the way that I like to run an office. I'm here 5 days a week in the office, unless I'm obviously traveling or meeting. But, you know, it's just a little bit different. I expect people to be here in the office so we can actually work together.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how I run things. You know, telecommuting or whatever may work for other people. For me, because I like to be in an office, I want my staff here. So I don't like to also plan meetings. If something needs to be talked about, we can, hey, are you free in 10 minutes? Great. Come on in. Let's talk about it and figure it out. Everyone moves on. You don't have to wait a day or two to figure something out. And hopefully that helps with everything else we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I guess it's good that you know yourself enough to know that, like, you were like, I can't.
I couldn't do it. I was like, I can't do this anymore. People talk.
Yeah.
Like, are you kidding me? We run a museum out there, and PASIC is 3 or 4 months away, and how come there's no music being played? Like, oh my gosh, this is like, no.
Yeah.
Talk to each other.
Yeah.
So I keep my door open as well, except for right now. I don't want to bother them.
Right.
But I'm also yelling. And I'll be like, Justin, you know, or you know, kind of looks around the corner. And,
right.
So they know who I am now, and they can do the same thing. And we have a very friendly group of people here. We get along. We try to hang out once in a while, also because I also feel it's important that we're also we like each other's company.
Yeah.
I mean, I see these people more than I see my family.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to enjoy each other and enjoy each other's company. And so that's constantly building that and making sure that people like each other. And we all do like each other and like working with each other. And we can have that open
kind of way of working with each other.
What types of things are different in terms of versus your last job in terms of kind of structure? And I'm thinking like maybe office or physical mm-hmm. things that are aside from a bit being in a different Midwestern city.
City, yeah. I don't have a window in my office.
Oh.
Well, I mean, I have a window that overlooks the staff, but we work in a basement.
Oh, okay. That could be. I see. I was like, yeah. Is the wall? How strong is the wall? Can you just put a sledgehammer in there and create the open space that you want?
I could. It would just end up being another dungeon somewhere else. I invite anyone who wants to come see the office. Come check out the office. There's lots of colors, but it is in the back of Rhythm Discovery Center in the basement. So we don't know if it's 90 degrees outside or if it's snowing. Right. You know, I don't know what's happening. I mean, it's – yeah. So that's a little different. You know, there's a lot of similarities. It's a similar size organization to what I was used for, which I really like. You know, I like being a what they would consider a large, small organization. Generally, things under in essentially in Chicago, anything over a $2 million organization, they actually considered a large organization.
Okay.
And at CYSO, we were like 1.5, 1.8, depending on the year, you know, different projects. Here, we're around that 1.5 as well. So you're large enough to do a lot of really great things, but you're still small enough to be agile, to be able to say, hey, let's try this and not have to go through so much. You know, we're not the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, you know, or the Art Institute or you know, whatever it may be, you know, pick the largest organization in your city, mm-hmm. Where you have meetings upon meetings to have a meeting and then you have to work with this group or that, you know, no, we talk about things, we build consensus, we have a plan and then we do it.
Right.
And I like that flexibility. Mm-hmm. And so that's the same size, similar size staff, similar size, budget, the board's a little bit smaller here than it was in Chicago, which is actually a little bit nicer to actually work with. That's something that has been great. And we have a very active board, which is amazing. They're all so good. And it's an honor for that, you know, to work with them because they really believe in PAS. Mm-hmm. And so I really actually enjoyed that when I actually had my interview talking about, you know, I could feel that passion in the board members and that, you know, this is something I really believed in this organization. There's no, in all the organizations I've ever worked with or for, the amount of passion that our board, our members, our past presidents, our you name it, the passion they have for PAS and the, everyone wants it to succeed. Mm. And that is a real, you don't see that everywhere,
yeah.
You know, and we have so many people who want to be leaders, some people who want, you know, to help where they can to make it successful. So to have that backing is, I'm very fortunate to have that. And so, you don't have that, and that's a little bit different. I mean, PAS in CYSO was a very well-known and established organization nationally amongst our peers, but locally we were just a small youth orchestra. Mm-hmm. Chicago is so large and there are so many gigantic arts organizations from world-class theaters and you know, and orchestras and museums or whatever. So that's a little bit harder actually in some ways to fundraise, to build that. But when you are the premier organization of your type, like PAS is, there's different challenges, but there's also, it's easier in some ways. And I'm enjoying some of the easier aspects of it.
Yeah.
That, you know, but obviously there are also harder aspects as well. And also the type of people that, you know, I'm also dealing with people who, when I was at CYSO, I actually knew more about youth orchestras than most any other person. Mm-hmm. I probably still know more about youth orchestras more than any other person. When I'm at PAS, I do not know more about percussion than most people in PAS. So that's a very different thing where I might know about organizational structure and how we're going to do this, but in terms of actually the product, we have experts in every one of the fields. So that's been a little bit also of a change in my dealing with people. Mm-hmm. And how I approach a subject. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to make a, I'm not going to also be like, drum set, we're going to do this. No, because, you know, we have a committee and we have people who've been, you know, are world-class educators and performers who you're going to talk to and get their information first. So that's a little bit different than the role that I did come from. But I'm enjoying that because I really enjoy talking to these amazing artists and teachers who are also so passionate about what we're doing. And so it makes my life really a lot easier to be able to, at any moment, anyone is that, you know, call me at any moment. And that is a luxury to have.
I'll phrase this as the, this is how this used to go. And I think, you know, you'll know about this, but you know, PASIC used to move around a lot and,
yeah,
you know, and I thought about, I enjoy when it's at, when it's an indie, and it's close to me. I'm in Columbia, Missouri, so it's a short jaunt for me. But you know, it used to be on the East Coast. It was on the West Coast very infrequently. It's been in Texas, which is, I think those have been really successful. And I'm curious about, is there any push to move it again, rather than having it centrally located as it is?
Yeah, I'll answer that question. Mm-hmm. We will be in Indianapolis until 2020.
Okay.
And I let everyone know that last year, and I actually was very specific on why, and I will share it with people here. When we moved to Indianapolis, the city helped us a lot with getting here, mm-hmm. helping us with Rhythm Discovery Center. So on and so forth. And so we made a commitment that we would be in Indianapolis 2 out of every 3 years.
Right.
And I think everyone was fine with that.
Yeah.
So in, if you step back a little bit, 2015, we were in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. 2016 and 17, Indianapolis.
Yeah.
2018, we were supposed to be somewhere. Mm-hmm. 19 and 20, Indianapolis. 21.
Yeah.
Moving forward. Okay. So 2018. So I got here in 2016, and by then we really should have had 2018 already booked. You can't just
Booked at another city.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I believe.
I am currently trying to. I'm currently have a few, and I can't go. I won't go into this where. Okay. But I'm hopefully right after PASIC, probably around somewhere between January and March of 2018, I will sign our 2021 contract.
Okay.
Because things are already full. People book now 3, 4, 5, 6 years out in advance.
Right.
That's fine. Mm-hmm. So to come in the end of 2016 and not have 2018 signed yet, but they were working on it. Just things weren't matching up.
Yeah.
We were close with one city. Mm-hmm. It was actually Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
We were close on Columbus, Ohio.
And those had been really good. I mean, I'd gone to the three in the 2000s that were there, and I was surprised how much I enjoyed those, even though they tended to be freezing, but they were
yes.
good.
So no problem. We were working on it. We were real close, to signing, and they came back and said, you can have it, but we can't give you the big performance hall on Saturday.
I'm sorry. So the they is the Columbus, their side, the Columbus yes. side. Okay.
The Columbus side said you can come here. We want you to have here. We just unfortunately that space is that your the big concert space is already booked for Saturday for something moving forward, and they won't relinquish it. Mm-hmm. And that is a deal breaker.
Yeah.
I mean, our Saturday night concert is this year. It's Steve Smith of the Airmen of Note. I mean, we're going to have 2,500 people sitting in a room. So that's a deal breaker.
Yeah.
And now we're already into almost at the end of 2016, 2017. And Indianapolis came back and said, that happened on a Sunday. And I remember then Indianapolis came back and said, yeah, we have a date, but H&R Block wants it, and if you don't tell us by tomorrow, we're going to give it to H&R Block for their convention, and then we would have been left with nothing.
Oh, wow.
So, so I decided to say, okay, book it. So I booked 2018 as our away year in Indianapolis, and then we already had a booking for 2019 and 2020 in Indianapolis.
Right.
That was already contracted.
Yes.
So the good news is, though, we will save a lot of money by staying in Indianapolis over those 5 years because we could sign a five-year contract. And the longer you're in one place, the bigger break they give you.
Right.
So it's like anything else with business.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes back to you. We used to move around a lot. This is true. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, they used to move around a lot when they could host their convention in a hotel.
Right.
Okay. So you could pick any hotel in any city in the country and do it. Well, many years ago, we became too large for a hotel. We need to actually have it in a convention center.
Yes.
And there are only so many convention centers in the U.S. where we can have our conventions.
And why is that?
And why is that? I was going to go to that. Why okay. The things that people don't think about.
Yes.
Okay. Here's my favorite one.
Okay.
Not all convention centers are built the same.
True.
So, true. If a convention center builds their convention center with the doors, you know, you go to a convention center and you have that a double door, but you have the post in the middle.
Oh yeah, okay.
Sure. What if the post doesn't come out?
Yep, that's kind of important for us.
So no marimbas and no marimbas and no timpani in any of those rooms.
Yep. That's can't do that.
Done.
Yeah.
There's quite a few that were built a long time ago that's not the way they're built.
Right.
The modern ones actually do have that availability.
Yeah.
That's great. Larger cities.
Mm-hmm.
So the way conventions are now booked are based on hotels. How many hotel blocks you can sell.
Mm-hmm.
So the money that we pay to rent out a convention center is like chump change to them. They don't care. They don't care about that. They care about how all the hotel tax.
I'm sorry. And again, this is the city is telling you this. Like they.
Oh, this is across the board.
That's the issue.
Yeah. This is across the board now.
Yeah.
So we are too small of a convention to have our convention in a place like Houston or Dallas or
Seattle. That's probably on the border.
So Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go. So, I love Seattle.
Oh yeah, I'd love to be going to Seattle again. I love Seattle too.
I'm not sure how many people we're going to get coming from New York and Boston and Texas. That's a long way.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's a whole another issue. When you look at the people who come to PASIC,
mm-hmm.
you know, and what the geographic makeup is, that's also something else we take into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about that. What goes into finding a venue?
The hotel.
If we don't, we are generally a small conference when it comes to hotels. People at PASIC don't like to get hotel rooms, or they like to shove eight people into a room. Now
right.
That's great. You're gonna share with your friends, but what it's gonna do is it's gonna say, well, PAS can't sell a lot of hotel rooms, which means we're not making a lot of hotel tax, which means they're not profitable for us as a city, which means we don't want them.
Yeah.
And so they will push us off. So Houston said to us, they said, you can come here, but if a bigger group comes in, we have the authority to kick you out of your date.
Oh.
So we can go to Houston, but they at any moment up until a year can kick us out of our date.
And then you're screwed because you can't find anywhere else.
Then there's nothing.
Yes.
Then there's nothing.
Yeah.
So you have to think – so people just think it's so easy. Well, why can't you have it in Boston? Why can't you have it in Dallas? Why can't you have it here?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's a lot that goes into it.
Mm-hmm.
It also costs a lot more money when we leave because we have to rent more more things. Mm-hmm. My staff lives here.
Yeah.
Have Rhythm Discovery Center. Mm-hmm. We have a set, you know, so it costs a lot more money when we go to a different city.
Yeah.
So I'm not opposed. We're not opposed to it, and we will go somewhere else in 2021. But there's only certain places that can do it, mm-hmm. since it's a convention center. If it was a hotel, if we were that small,
yeah,
sure. But it's not as easy as just picking a place. The other part is also union.
Okay.
Different cities, we just can't afford the union cost. We can't do a convention in
Anywhere in California at this point, I would bet.
It's very hard in Chicago.
Yeah.
So different cities and different states have different union rules, which also then play a part. We can go to it. If people are willing for me to double the cost of coming to PASIC, mm-hmm. let's go anywhere.
Yeah.
Then that would be an issue. So what people want is a cheap convention in a different city.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to pick and choose what's important to you. And the other part is I would ask people, why the different city? If the program, if the convention itself is world class, and the artists that come in are world class, and I can provide a better social experience for you than what's been happening, would you consider coming back to Indianapolis? And in hopefully this year, you'll see some of that, a few extra trying to get people out of the downtown market. Take a $5 Uber ride and go to Fountain Square, or go to Mass Avenue, or go to Broad Ripple, which might be a $10 Uber ride. But there's a lot of other restaurants and nightlife spots in Indianapolis that people don't go to because they want to walk. But no city has a great – I mean, everything by a convention center is going to be somewhat – I mean, that's what convention centers do. They put kind of, you know – you're gonna get your chain or your big bar and grill. Fine, that's the way most conventions are. Centers, cities are. But if you go outwards a little bit, so I guarantee that most people who come to Indianapolis year after year haven't ventured out a little bit. And so I would say before you say, you know, I've seen everything in Indianapolis, make sure you've actually seen everything in Indianapolis. And I guarantee you haven't, because I live here and I've been here for a year and a half, and I have only touched the surface. And there's a lot of great food restaurants, a lot of like clubs, a lot of great night stuff, nightlife. Yeah. And you're only going to be here for 3 days.
Yeah. I've thought about this because my wife is a communication professor. And so her conference is a lot of people. Her big conferences are a lot of people, but they're in like the biggest cities. Every time she tells me where she's going, I'm like, oh, that would be awesome to go there. And, you know,
is there an expo hall?
No, it's not a – no, I'm, this is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a conference, not a convention.
Right. So fair enough. Yes. Right? So you go into a conference. All right.
You go to a conference. A conference can – to me, the difference is a conference can happen in a hotel. A convention happens in a convention center.
Yes.
And we can easily have a conference.
Yeah.
But it would be boring.
Well, the other part of this, I agree with that too. But what I've also thought about is that one of the issues – not an issue, but it's a feature of our organization is that it's for not hers is like all professionals, and we right. have all ages,
and so all ages,
and that's kind of part of the issue I know with the hotels is that that's probably I would bet that's a lot of high school and college who are just like trying to save money, and so they'll just pack everybody,
yeah.
And, you know, what can you do? Yeah. It's like, there's not really much you can do about that. And that's it changes right. how you
and
set
we
up.
And we're lucky that Indianapolis, generally, when you look at other hotel, Indianapolis hotel rates are going to be cheaper than some of these other cities. Mm. Now, I think San Antonio is a real viable option for another future one.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
I think it was very successful down there. So I wouldn't count that out. We've looked into other East Coast things.
Yeah.
But all these factors come in. You know, what's it going to cost in terms of getting us there? What's it cost for hotels rooms for night? If we go to a city that the hotel rooms are $50 more a night than they are in Indianapolis, our members will boycott that, and so will the exhibitors. You know, they're spending thousands and thousands of dollars to come every place. So if you're going to a place that then they're going to have to pay even more for, you know, your for a hotel night per room, because they're booking 20 and 30, you know, a night.
Right.
And it's going to be an extra $50 a night. You know, I don't want to offend them either. Sure. So, you know, but I also want to make sure that, but they will want to spend that if it's in a location that maybe will get more people there. So I'm also always, I'm talking to our corporate sponsors, our exhibitors a lot, because what they have to say matters as well, because we can't do PASIC without them.
Yeah.
They are the most generous group of people that you can imagine are corporate sponsors and exhibitors. And so I speak a lot with them about this, because it is just as much theirs as it is, you know, ours. Because they are part of us. I mean, it is PAS would not be anything without the corporations of, you know, of in the world that produce all the percussion equipment. So I speak a lot to them to make sure that we're all on the same page.
Yeah, for sure. Are they, when you're, I'm curious, when you got to the position, did you look back on like just every pace, like it just kind of like looking at kind of the final result and all that stuff? Because the one curiosity I'm just curious about is the two, when they were in Anaheim and Orlando in the late 90s, and that was like one of the last times that they were ever, I think, unless they might have been, but anyway, but I was thinking about like those two spots, because they were, I think, one of the last ones that were on the coasts.
Ah, yes, I was at the 97 Anaheim one.
Mm-hmm.
I would, yes, I mean, I would love to get back to a coast at some point. And it may not necessarily be a PASIC.
Okay.
That we have at a coast. Mm-hmm. How about that? I'll leave a little bit of intrigue.
Ooh.
That, let's see here. Yeah. Since 2006 Austin, 2007 Columbus, 2008 Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Then we started the Indianapolis run.
Yeah.
And then Austin in 12, San Antonio in 15, Nashville in 2004, Louisville in 2003, Columbus in 2002, Nashville in 2001, Dallas in 2000. Yeah, we've been very Texas and Midwestern. Yeah, 98 Orlando, 97 Anaheim.
Yeah.
95 was Phoenix. 94 was Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
But those were at, you know, hotels. Some of those were at hotels.
Oh, not – they weren't in convention centers.
No.
Okay.
I mean, not all of them.
Yeah.
It started to kind of go back and forth. So, you know, the Anaheim one was actually at the Disneyland Hotel.
Okay.
That wasn't actually at the Anaheim Convention Center where NAMM is at. So,
yeah.
You know, you know, convention towns are changing, and also what PAS wants, you know, is focusing on in terms of interactive experiences.
Mm-hmm.
That's something we talk about a lot here. The interactive experience of PAS, getting people together, having these opportunities. There's so much content on the web that you can go and watch a video, but that's very one-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what PAS does better than anyone else is actually bringing people together, whether it's for a masterclass or whether it's for a PASIC. And I think that what you might see in the future is a way for us to get together more often, maybe not as large as a PASIC,
mm-hmm.
but still for these interactive opportunities or smaller, you know, regional. Maybe we have a regional day of percussion where we combine, you know, multiple or whole, you know, East Coast, you know, the same way they do things for, you know, different MEAs. You know, sometimes they don't, on the East Coast, they don't have a Massachusetts and a Rhode Island and a Vermont. They actually have an all Eastern, you know, they kind of combine forces, you know, and,
yeah,
you know, or West Coast type of thing. So there are ways for us, because, you know, we know we have a good, you know, 5,000-6,000 people come to PASIC,
mm-hmm.
you know, but there are tens of thousands of people who would come to one of these things. Maybe, so maybe we have to do a better job of actually going to.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we have something in California, if we have something in California, you know, will the Florida people come? If we have something in Florida, will the Seattle, Washington people come?
Right.
If we have, you know, so you're always not going to be able to get some people. So instead of trying to pick one place that is for everybody, we might have to do a better job of having some other regional things. And we might be able to do that because we're really good at it. We're really good at this percussion festival convention type of thing, to attract a lot of students and enthusiasts. And so that's a little hint about maybe something down the pipeline.
What other parts of your job are there that we haven't covered that are like pretty central to what you do?
I run Rhythm Discovery Center, which is major initiative.
Yeah.
If you're saying, what's Rhythm Discovery Center?
No, I'm not. Someone might be listening,
what's Rhythm Discovery Center?
Yeah.
Rhythm Discovery Center is essentially interactive drum and percussion museum that is a creative vision of percussive art society. It's a program. It's a program, PAS. It's kind of our face here in Indianapolis.
Okay.
And it is an unbelievable museum that was kind of one of the real reasons why we were able to move to Indianapolis to help us build out this. And it is, we have amazing exhibits, but we also, this is where we store our collection of historical percussion instruments. And we have so many incredible instruments that have been donated to us over the years. If you've ever been to Rhythm Discovery Center, you should come. And if you come for PASIC, it's free. You just come and show your badge. But it is, so that is a major thing that I deal with. In fact, we're having a lot of work done right now on it to get ready for PASIC. So that's definitely something that I'm constantly working on, new programs, new exhibits. It's a whole other world when we talk about, museums. So, what our role in Indianapolis is, because we are a national, international organization, but we're also a very local Indianapolis organization with Rhythm. Yeah. So being really active in the Indianapolis art scene. And then there's just the general membership, everything from Days of Percussion to some of the other initiatives that we have going on, different commissions, or like I said, working with the board on long range planning.
Yeah.
Thinking about things that we're going to do in 3 years from now, or how we're going to get there. What's our process going to be to get there? Mm-hmm. Thinking way out in terms of, I think my I'm currently thinking a year out. I eventually start thinking 2 years out. And then there's definitely a portion of the year that it's pretty much, 80 or 90% just the upcoming PASIC.
Right.
Because it's such a large part of our year and our budget, that all hands on deck. Yeah. And eventually I like to get away from that. I have a great team to do that. I'm still in that process that I still manage a lot of the parts of PASIC, or at least things come through my desk. Maybe that will change, but as of right now, that's definitely a few months worth of work that we do. And at the same time, there's all these other projects going on that you have to manage as well. But that's obviously a key part of it. Mm-hmm.
Is there a significant setup change at Rhythm that's different from the week of PASIC versus the rest of the year?
We use PASIC as a deadline to update exhibits. So when people come to PASIC, they see something, but that has taken months to get to that point. And then sometimes, I know in years past, like the night before, they're still in there like hanging new signs and putting new exhibits up and whatnot. So there are a lot of very new parts of it that people come for PASIC don't necessarily see. But then once PASIC is done, then we then let the community know, hey, come back to Rhythm Discovery Center. We have updated, this exhibit in this area, and we put new instruments out here. So there will be a pretty significant change this year at Rhythm. And I don't want to talk about it too much, but I encourage people to come by and just take a look.
You did mention briefly memberships. What's been the year, almost year and a half you've been there, what's been the conversations in terms of Because there's always been issues with access. There's always been issues with other organizations that do similar things, whether they be with corporate and sponsors and things like that. So mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, are those conversations, I assume, are being had, and
yeah,
how's that going?
Yeah, well, I started to make a larger push for, so we created a group membership program, mm-hmm. which is something we've never done before at PAS. And the group membership program is something that we started for specifically for K-12 education organizations and nonprofit organizations who serve students in K-12.
Yeah.
And it was a way for us, instead of having to be like, oh, you're a 10th grader, you should get this $30 membership and then try to renew again next year. It's so hard as opposed to saying, hey, will your high school pay $250? That $250 includes unlimited student memberships for as many students as you want. It gets one all access for your director. It gives everyone access to the website, everyone access to all the competitions and things we do. It's way easier to manage. And frankly, it's actually starting to drive our membership base up, mm-hmm. because one school could have 40 new kids.
Yeah.
You know, who never would have been a member before. But so we started that, and we actually have 50 group members, mm-hmm. in our first year, which was our goal. And you think of it, it's easy, but to try to sell a new membership program to people, but we hit 50, group members, which is about 1,000 new members, because each school is going to have, on average, you know, could have as little as 10, as many as 40 percussion students, you know? And that's great, because now we're starting to build that member base again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've talked about, you know, our membership declining. It's less that it's declining, it's more just, we're in a different age, you know. People expect different things from their associations.
Yeah.
And also, different generation wants everything for free.
Right. Yeah.
So this is something that we talk a lot about, because obviously we've been an individual member-driven organization for so long.
Yeah.
And so we're constantly thinking about these things, which is the health of the organization, you know, and what can still set us apart from other organizations or other resources, you know. And if other groups are doing something really high level, why fight that? We should embrace it, and we should think about things that we do really well, and that we do better than anyone else, and that will still make it appealing for someone to want to be a member of PAS. I think they were still just trying things within the same model of individual. How do we get more one-off people too? So as someone who's done development for many years, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
There are two models.
Yeah.
You know, you see this in politics as well. You know, Barack Obama did an amazing job of getting lots and lots and lots of people to give $5 and $10 and $20, right?
Right.
You know, Bernie Sanders said the same thing. His whole thing is set $27, right? You know.
Right, right.
That's great. I don't know if that works for PAS.
Sure.
Right, trying to get a lot of $20 and $30 people doesn't work for us. The same thing with gifts, with donations. You know, I'm someone who it takes a lot of time to try to get a lot of people to give $5, $10, and $20.
Yeah.
So I spend more of my time trying to find people who are going to give $5, $10, and $20,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's more worth it. More worth it to me.
Yeah.
So when it came to the group membership, it was like, okay, well, let's really work with the educators. Instead of trying to talk to the parent and the kid about a membership, no, let's just go directly here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and then hopefully that by the time they get to be in college, they'll want to maybe be an individual member because they know it's important to their future growth or whatever it may be. So that's just a new approach to it. So I think they tried new things. They just they still kept it within that individual, only individuals. And you have to think beyond just individual.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's when that's been explained, I feel like you're like, yes, sure. What a great idea.
Why not?
Is there any push to do something like that for colleges too, or is it are we just limiting it to high school and or younger at this point? Or
yeah, to be continued.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
There have been many questions by university professors, mm-hmm. And teachers and students. Am I opposed to it? No. Mm-hmm. We would really have to strategically think about what that looks like.
Yeah.
You know, and the why we would do it or whatever it may be. So change is good if you are really thinking about it. You know, the group membership for K-12 was a no-brainer because we really weren't getting those students anyway. Right. We have a lot of people at this other level, so we really have to think about the why, what the long-term effects on PAS it would have. So we are thinking about that. Also about like studios.
Yeah.
Can a private teacher get a group membership for a studio? They're, you know, if they're technically not a nonprofit, but they have a studio, little things like that. So we're going to see how the group memberships work in the original way with K-12 and nonprofits.
Yeah.
Who's K-12, and then we'll start to think about if it makes sense for us to expand that.
Yeah.
But we're not opposed to it. But we can have a follow up after, and hopefully we talk about how successful PASIC 17 is, and maybe even start to talk about some of the artists that we have lined up for 2018 already, which is, 2018. We're already working on artists for 2018. I tell you, we're working in advance. We'll be able to share with you. I'll tell you this on the next podcast. I'll share with you some of the artists we have lined up for 2018 already. How about that?
How about that? Not a bad tease, am I right? So yes, I will bring Joshua back on after PASIC concludes to talk about how the event went, give us an update on who we can expect to perform at PASIC 2018, and to find out more about him and his journey to executive director. Plus, I hope some random ass questions. Stay tuned! And in lieu of a rave this week, come to PASIC in Indianapolis. It is all the things Joshua mentioned, all the great performances, lots of catching up with friends and colleagues, buying more music and equipment than you'll ever play or use, sitting in on early morning committee meetings, going jogging in the freezing cold, do the fun runs. All of it. November 8th through 11th. Be there. Thanks again for listening. Please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where you can leave a comment and a rating. That'd be great, so go do that. The show notes and all episodes are always located on the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud and Stitcher. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can contact me there, on Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. I'll catch you next time for the second part of the PASIC 2017 preview, featuring guests old and new. Until then.